Earlier in the show, we talked a bit about The Economist magazine and why you might want to consider reading sources of information that are not domestic. You can learn a lot. And joining me at this point to talk about some things in the news is our old friend Steve Alexander. Welcome back, Steve.
Glad to be here, Doctor.
It's about time you came back.
Been busy.
How's the ankle, by the way?
Ankle's fine. Uh-huh. I've recovered.
Because we did tell our
audience. Are we really going to go there?
Yeah, we did tell our audience about how you'd sprained the ankle in the annual McGeorge King Law School ambulance chase.
That's not accurate at all. But
no? What happened?
Well, actually, I was trying to introduce myself to a widow at a funeral. I think her husband had been, accidentally fell into a brush cutter.
I think I read about that.
Yeah, so, you know, it was a tough moment, but I was going to introduce myself to the widow, who I'd never met before, and leaned over to hand her my card. And the beer holding the 3,000-pound Philippine mahogany casket fell on my foot.
Oh, my.
And have a subtalar fracture and... Uh-huh. You know, torn ligaments and my...
But on the positive side, not only did you reach the widow, you were able to have a product liability suit against the casket manufacturer.
Exactly. Exactly. So I was happy to, turn that into a positive like I do with most things.
You should view the glass as being half full, I think.
Yeah, sure. Of course, I really don't subscribe to that kind of conduct and embarrassed by those that do engage in that kind of, ambulance chasing. It makes a funny story, but, actually I have a deep tissue sarcoma in my ankle. I'd appreciate you being somewhat empathetic.
I will try to be sensitive to your plight. Well, I wanted you to follow my lead on this one, Steve, because The Economist here is a very, very good magazine. They give very in-depth coverage on a lot of issues.
Where's it published?
It's British. When I took a year off about a decade and a half ago, I thought during my year abroad I would be ill-informed about goings-on here in the United States. I was startled to discover that by reading foreign sources of journalism, I was actually much better informed about what was going on in the United States than I was if I was watching network television, especially if I was watching network television here in America. The Economist is very conservative, and they're kind of rah-rah cheerleaders for, like, globalization. They got some perspectives I don't always agree with, but when it comes to comprehensive news coverage, they're pretty tough to beat. But one article they had here on their Christmas special, why are conspiracy theories so popular? They had a little essay that they went on about. Today, we're going to debunk, I think for our listening audience, one that's not a real conspiracy, but it's kind of the classic, there's a vast cabal, a secret group that's intriguing to control the world that unfortunately a lot of people believe in, and that is one of the most evil yet successful hoaxes in the history of literature, at least the last century, that of the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. A lot of folks, I'm sure, listening to this have never heard of this because it doesn't get a lot of play. You could contend, I think, with complete legitimacy that the extremists who attacked the U.S. on September 11th were influenced by this book. It's given a great deal of credence in the Middle East. The Egyptian government had an airing of a documentary supposedly on the Protocols of Zion.
What are they?
Well, let's tell the story. A document first appeared in Russia in 1905 that was purportedly the transcripts of some meetings that outlined a secret plan by Jews to take over the world.
So KGB originated.
Well, let's go through it. Once this document surfaced, they were used by the Russian government to justify pogroms against Jews. They were officially tolerated attacks. It was translated into German, gained wide credence. Adolf Hitler cites it in Mein Kampf. It was used to justify Nazi oppression of the Jews. It was widely translated before World War II. By some estimates, it achieved the greatest circulation of any modern literary work. An Arabic version spread through the Muslim world in the 1920s. We mentioned the fact that it turned up on Egyptian TV recently. King Faisal of Saudi Arabia, assassinated in the 70s, used to give copies to foreign visitors to explain why Saudi Arabia was, so angry at Israel. The Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion is a fake. Its author was a man named Peter Rechkovsky. He headed from 1884 to 1902 the foreign branch of the Russian secret police. It was then called the Okhrana, the forerunner to the KGB. He was stationed in Paris and apparently was assisted by an aide in this forgery. It first saw print in 1903 in a Ukrainian newspaper in abbreviated form. In 1905, the larger version, from which all subsequent copies derive, appeared. It was as a 2,500-word appendix to a book called The Great in the Little, which was written by an apocalyptic mystic named Sergei Nihilus. And, of course, Nihilus, like most such literature, was warning that the Antichrist was imminent.
So what was it based on? I mean, why did it have any credibility at all other than the old, you know, sort of Jew-baiting stuff that had gone on for years?
This is what is really kind of puzzles me about this, how this managed to be such a successful work. The Protocols of Zion was alleged to be the transcript of a speech delivered to a cabal of 300 prominent Jews. In Nihilus's second edition, which came out in 1917, it was specified that the speaker was Theodor Herzl, the real-life founder of the Zionist movement. He was a journalist from Vienna. He traveled to France in the 1890s and was shocked by the anti-Semitic sentiment he discovered there. He was not a particularly devout person. He was not a devout Jew. But France, at this point in time, was in the throes of the Dreyfus Affair.
That was a prosecution of a French Jewish artillery captain for espionage.
Yeah.
And later proved to be false. There was...
He was framed.
He was totally framed. And framed. Apparently by right-wing, you know, political elements and the military and by the Catholic Church.
Well, they really did have a spy in the French military who was leaking secrets to the Germans. And when it sort of got wind of the fact that there was a spy in their midst, they went looking for who he might be. And Dreyfus was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Being this Jewish artillery captain, they thought, I guess with the anti-Semitic bias, it must have been him. And no sooner was he accused than people started lining up, you know, along political factions. The military, the right wing, and unfortunately the Catholic Church supported the railroading. And basically liberal elements in France were trying to back him up. The guy winds up getting convicted and sent to Devil's Island.
Convicted twice.
What's amazing is this became a huge cause célèbre in France. Liberal elements said, this is ridiculous. And when it turned out that they found out who really was the spy, and they found out there was a forgery that framed him, amazingly, the military, rather than admit that they'd railroaded the guy, decided that they were just going to, you know, he was guilty. They were going to, like, stick to their guns. And he winds up getting amazingly convicted a second time, but then promptly pardoned, which is how the political solution that sort of extracted them from, you know, this ongoing furor, which lasted just for years. It was tearing France apart.
And apparently led to, as I understand it, a separation of church and state in France in the aftermath.
They did not have that in France. We have it in this country. It's one of the founding principles of the United States. But yeah, France pretty much at that point decided that we need to not mix up our state affairs with the Catholic Church.
And so going back to Herzl being totally shocked about what was going on in France.
Well, France was supposed to be the most liberal country in Europe. Theodor Herzl was indeed the father of the Zionist movement. He saw what was going on in France. He concluded that until the Jewish people can again have a land to call their own, they are going to be basically, you know, possibly the victims of ongoing anti-Semitism everywhere. In the Dreyfus case, it galvanized Herzl into saying, we need to have land somewhere. And there'd been no political base for the Jewish people since ancient times. Since basically the first and second centuries AD, and this was the beginning of a movement which eventually culminated in the creation of the modern state of Israel. So Theodor Herzl was indeed the father of the movement.
And the movement was called Zionism.
Yes.
And it contemplated a return of Jews to Palestine.
They weren't sure about whether it would be Palestine at first. That was debated back and forth, but a state somewhere. He published a book called Der Judenstaat, The Jewish State, became the manifesto of the movement, and they held a World Congress in Basel, Switzerland in 1897. And I think Herzl later said that was the beginning. Basically, he'd given birth to modern state of Israel. They knew that out of that meeting that a movement would take form, and it did. So fast forward, it's 1917, it's 20 years later, and this book appears in Russia that claims that they have transcripts of the meeting. What's so amazing is the bizarre nature of what's purported to be these transcripts.
I rhetorically ask, How do we know that these transcripts were not actual transcripts from this cabal of prominent Jewish leaders at the first Congress of the Zionist movement?
People went back later, looked at what was in this book, and found that it had been lifted from two prior works. One was a political satire from 1864, and one was a work of fiction from 1868. The 1864 work was a political satire making fun of the Emperor Napoleon III, who managed to get himself elected leader of France by the fact that his name was Bonaparte. He was related to the famous Napoleon, even though he himself was kind of a jerk without really much talent, which he soon demonstrated once he won the election and started ruling the nation of France. They were making fun of him in this satire, being that he was a bit of a buffoon, and that this guy Maurice Joly wrote a work called A Dialogue in Hell Between Montesquieu and Machiavelli. And they made the emperor look foolish by putting his words as a dialogue between these two political philosophers. So that's part one. So it's a bizarre, it's a satire. And they were able to correlate these transcripts to this book from, like, you know, a generation earlier.
And then there was a second work that was used to create the protocols.
A guy named Hermann Gertsche wrote a book called Biarritz, which contains a chapter about a supposed nighttime meeting in a Jewish cemetery in Prague, during which the leaders of the mythic 12 tribes of Israel were described as meeting with the devil. They then accounted for their activities in the intervening century since their last such convocation, and the Jewish leaders report on the strides they're making for world domination and, of course, the undermining of Christian morality, the health of the populace, and family life in general. So the Jewish people were supposedly exploiting the stock exchange, attempting to gain control of the press while undermining governments. This fantastic meeting with the devil gets put as a transcript that actually takes place in Basel, Switzerland, and somehow the light bulb hasn't gone over people's heads. It's puzzling. I don't know what motivated Rachofsky, who came up with this fantastic bit of fantasy. Now, apparently these protocols were first accepted as genuine by Tsar Nicholas II, a man of notable anti-Semitic sentiments, but when investigation showed that it was a fraud, the Tsar, to his credit, banned its use as propaganda, but pogroms against the Jews did go on, however, influenced by it. Now, 1905, there was some turmoil in Russia when this first surfaced, but it didn't cause the furor that it could have until 1917 in the Bolshevik Revolution. At this point in time, the Bolsheviks have toppled the monarchy, and prominent among the revolutionaries are numerous Jews. Leon Trotsky, real name Lev Bronstein, had worked in a Jewish newspaper in Brooklyn. Karl Marx, the founder of communism, was of Jewish extraction. Lenin may have been partly Jewish as well. The opponents of the Bolsheviks built upon a long tradition of Russian anti-Semitism, and the White Army, which was the counter-revolutionaries, blamed the October Revolution on the Jews. The whites then saw to it that the protocols got revived and disseminated. And during the Russian Civil War, which took place between 1918 and 1920, probably 100,000 Jews were killed as Russia's woes were blamed on them.
Another large pogrom.
In essence, yet another in the long continuing series of Russian pogroms against the Jews. But it actually gets worse than that from here. There's even believers in America. It gets translated into English. Henry Ford publishes the protocols in his newspaper, The Dearborn Independent, in 1920. He later puts out a book called The International Jew, a book on the same topic. Ford gets sued in 1927 by Aaron Shapiro, a Jewish lawyer. Ford takes a look at it, to his credit, determines the charges he'd been making were false, makes a public apology to the Jewish community.
Although later in the 30s was a pal, apparently, of Germany. And despite all of the indications of anti-Semitic problems in Germany, went to great pains to partner up with or shoulder up with the industrialism of Germany and Adolf Hitler and how wonderful the new Nazi party was.
Well, apparently Hitler, the only American's picture he had on his desk was that of Henry Ford, a man he admired, and cites his admiration for Ford in Mein Kampf. But in Germany, of course, things go really, you know, things go completely out of control. In 1920, the German National People's Party uses propaganda of a Jewish world conspiracy to further their ends. The protocols get published. They sell like 120,000 copies immediately. Looking back at it, like how a work that's composed of a satirical dialogue and a fantasy about, you know, necromancy out in the cemetery gets bought as a legitimate transcript of Theodore Herzl is just, I don't get it.
It had a long tradition. It isn't like it was a new thought at that point in time. I mean, the diaspora and the problems that the Jews and a number of other peoples that, you know, had suffered over hundreds of years, this really, to me, just sort of codified or tried to give some sort of formal legitimacy to the theory that Jews, gypsies, internationalists, homosexuals, etc., were, you know, being on the outside, had, you know, were really, you know, executing a conspiracy to make all that is otherwise well and good theirs and, you know, take over the world. I mean, that's not a new concept.
A certain right-wing Bavarian politician was able to make a lot of political hay out of this.
Would he have also been a paper hanger?
Yeah, I mean, Hitler was portraying the ideas, and he had a lot of backing, you know, that what happened to Germany in World War I was they'd been stabbed in the back. They'd been betrayed, stabbed in the back by Jews, first and foremost. He launches his, you know, campaign to rectify the situation, and that brought about basically World War II and the Holocaust. So this volume has a role to play in the great modern catastrophe of the Holocaust. And more recently, you know, in the Arab community in the Middle East, this book is read and believed to be an actual, again, it's hard to imagine that in the modern world people can believe this and accept this as legitimate, but people do.
Well, you got to consider the source, the people that are believing it. I mean, I'm not sure, do they believe it or are they using it? In other words, if you take any group of people that are predisposed towards another group, and you hand them what is perceived at a minimum to be a good tool, I'm not sure that it's necessarily true that they believe it, but they see it as a effective tool. By way of example, this production of the, you know, the documentary being produced currently in Egypt, I mean, do they really believe it? Who knows? But does it sell well? Yeah, it's like The Sopranos. I mean,
you're saying it's basically being cynically used as propaganda by certain people.
It is.
Well, I've never seen a copy of it. I understand you can get it in a lot of foreign locations. I never have actually laid my eyes on a copy of Protocols of Zion.
Yeah, I think you can get it there. There's a couple available in a bookstore in Idaho, Sandpoint, Idaho.
By
Coeur d'Alene.
I don't doubt that.
You can also get up there the Turner Diaries, weapons of a number of different types of weapons. It's.
Well, anyway, some conspiracies are real, some conspiracies are false. There is no vast Jewish conspiracy to take over the world.
Well, you say there isn't. Isn't it true that they do control the press? Again, rhetorically.
No,
rhetorically
they don't.
Positioned just to get the response.
It is. You do hear this.
Don't they control ABC and CBS and NBC?
No, they don't.
Who does?
Well, apparently a lot of big corporations do, and we're going to have to come back and talk about that in some future shows. We made allusion to that in our first segment, and maybe you'd be the guy to come back and we can walk through that. Because, yeah, I mean, corporate America, there's a tremendous amount of consolidation at this point, not a lot of alternate voices, and it sure as heck ain't the liberal media.
Agreed.
Well, Steve, I'm glad we cleared up some air on one of history's most insidious hoaxes, and thanks for coming.
I was happy to be here, as always, Doctor.
You're listening to Radio Parallax on KDVS 90.3 FM. I am your host, Douglas Everett. We've got to take a short break. Сидите, чувствуете, что вот на свете.